From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. When you visit the Illinois Supreme Court building in Springfield, one of the stops on the tour is called the Attorney's Room. It's where lawyers hang their coats, have a glass of water, and nervously eye their opposing counsel as they make final preparations before arguing before the court. The room is dominated by more than 100 portraits of almost everyone who has served on the High Court. It's an amazing depiction of the changing styles of men's facial hair and neckwear since 1818, when Illinois became the 21st state. These photos, almost all men, almost all white, are in stark contrast to murals throughout the building. Those, painted by Albert Krabel, depict various allegories of the law and justice. And in keeping with tradition, justice is depicted as a woman. And that cosmic irony, mostly women depicted as justice, mostly men as the justices, is about to be rebalanced, and in a big way. When the two women who won seats on the court this month are sworn in, the Illinois Supreme Court will comprise 5 women and 2 men, and they'll be led by Chief Justice Mary Jane Tice, only the 4th woman to serve in that role, and in fact the 4th woman on the Illinois Supreme Court, period. Chief Justice Tice attended Loyola University for her undergraduate studies and the University of San Francisco for law school, graduating in 1974. She was an assistant public defender in Cook County from then until 1983, when she became a trial judge. Tice became an appellate judge in the 90s and was appointed to the Supreme Court in 2010. She was just retained for an additional 10-year term at this month's election, and more importantly for our purposes today, she was recently elected by her colleagues to serve a 3-year term as Chief Justice. And so with that, Chief Justice Mary Jane Tice, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much. And oh, I loved your description of the courthouse in Springfield, and I do hope when people visit Springfield to see the historic sites there, they have an opportunity to go and see all of the pictures, and most specifically the murals. The murals are amazing. That view from 1908 of a woman as justice is very powerful throughout the building. I'm glad you noticed.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I spent a lot of time there. I used to be the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin reporter in Springfield. So let me ask you, I want to begin with this point about the gender balance on the court. And I did a little research. Illinois is actually not going to be the most woman numerous court by percentage. Wisconsin actually has 6 out of 7, and Washington State has 7 out of 9 justices who are women. Why do you think that courts, especially appellate courts, are really the first branch of government to achieve, and in some cases exceed, gender parity?
Well, let's start with the fact that law schools today are, if not gender balanced, most of them have more women students than male students. So generally across the legal profession, we're seeing more and more women coming into the profession. And although, as you pointed out, there have not historically been women in leadership in our state in terms of the court system, that has changed, is changing very rapidly throughout our court system. We're at a point now where if you look at the circuit court benches, they are, many, many women there. Certainly on the appellate court, in my area, in the Cook County, the first district, a large number of women on the courts. So it's evolving. It's taken some time, but these changes are part of a larger picture of the legal profession across the board.
Your former colleague, Supreme Court Justice Rita Garman, has talked about when she attended law schools a little before you. She was in the 60s. She said one of her instructors told her she was just there to catch a husband and was basically taking up a seat that should have gone to a man. I wonder how welcoming you found the legal profession, law school, and the profession when you started.
I am not a heroine like Rita Garman or Marianne McMorrow or Myra Bradwell. I went to school, as you pointed out, in 1974. So I graduated. I started law school in 1971. My husband, it turns out, is a year ahead of me, and he went to the same school. And when he started, there were 7 women in his class. The next year, when I began my law school training, there were 35 women in my class. Now, as I say, today it's 50-50 or 52% women in the law school classes. But I point out my statistic in that I really was right at the beginning of change, a very quick change in just, you know, 1 year. There are five times as many women in the law school class. And so I did not face the terrible discrimination that Rita Garman did, with not only she was told that she was just taking up space, she had, you know, the highest honors from graduation, and yet she had a terrible time finding a position. No one would hire her. They talked about her, well, maybe they could bring her on as a secretary, not as a lawyer, despite her academic successes. That's not what I faced. I came sometime later. Now, there's no doubt that when I became a public defender, and I was working in the felony courts in Cook County, there were a few other women, not many, but a few. So I was not alone. But I was usually the only woman in the courtroom. Now, today you just don't see that. Women are, you know, whether it's the trial court or the appellate court, and now the Supreme Court, you're seeing more and more women. And I'll tell you, that's also true in terms of the advocates we see who are arguing cases before the Illinois Supreme Court. Very often, the lawyers on both sides of cases are all women. So yes, change, it took a while. I was not, I was fortunate to be right on the wave of change.
When did you know you wanted to become a lawyer?
Well, you know, we all have our own stories. Mine sounds simple. My father was a judge. So, of course, I was going to be a lawyer, except, of course, that's not how I saw it at the time. Before my dad was a judge, he was a state legislator. And for many years, when I was little, my mom and I would take the train down to Springfield, and we would be with my dad, and then we'd go to the House of Representatives, and you know, I'd sit in the gallery, and eventually, as I got a little older, I got to hear what was going on and kind of start to understand. And the big issue of the day was civil rights. And as a young person, you know, my eyes just opening up to the world, that's how I was introduced to the ideas about racism and injustice and anti-Semitism. And in the same moment, the laws that were being debated in the legislature were about righting wrongs, making change, making a more just society. So from an early age, I experienced, I saw, I felt that law could be is an important positive impact on our society. It just took me a while to put all the pieces together to figure out, oh, okay, the way I can participate in that that action is to go to law school myself. Surprised no one except myself, I suppose. My parents were not surprised. I'm certainly glad that that's the path that I chose.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with the new Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court, Mary Jane Tice. She began her 3-year term this month, I believe. You mentioned your work as a public defender. I think that was your first job in the law. It's been my observation that that's not nearly as common among judges as having worked as a prosecutor. I wonder how that work informed your experience as a judge.
Very much so. Representing someone who is alone and afraid and has no one else, almost by definition, is a transformative experience. My clients would look to me as their only hope. Sometimes they did have family, and I would be able to get to know their family and see how this experience was impacting them, beyond just the crime, the crime victim, but the impact that crime has in a larger sense throughout the community. Those are very powerful lessons to learn early on in my career, and very much stay with me. I try to think about those clients. I hope I serve them well, but I know they changed me. And as I approach my cases, I try to keep that vision in front of me, that these cases are not about paper movement or whatever, computer screens moving around. These are real people's lives. Every single decision we make is going to have, for good or not, it's going to have a huge impact on individuals, on communities, on families, on businesses. So those early experiences continue to have an impact on me, not only in dealing with criminal cases, but across the board, of what is it that we're trying to do here? What is the purpose of the court system? And ultimately, it's the people whose lives are being affected by it.
Does that sort of thing come up? I maybe people don't necessarily understand how a court like the Supreme Court works. Attorneys file briefs over a period of months. They write out their arguments. They cite their past cases. They show up in Springfield or wherever the court is holding session, usually Springfield. They make their arguments. There's a strict time limit. That red light goes off. The case is over. The justices file into a conference room. You sit around a table. Does your experience as a public defender come into what happens at that table?
I'm going to let you in on a secret. I think what reviewing court judges fear most, what keeps us up at night, is unintended consequences. Yes, we've read the briefs, you've read the cases, we've heard the arguments. We could be persuaded this is a good rule in this case. But we understand that we can adopt a rule that's going to affect lots of other cases, and not just currently pending. It's going to affect people's lives in the future, what we say today. And so there's always a concern about the larger impact of the result in a case. We can define a word that's being used in this contract, but who knows how that word is used in other places? Will we upset the apple cart someplace else? So having a sense, a larger sense of how the courts work, how individuals' interaction with the courts work is very, very important and helpful to me. There's a case about an issue about a jury and how the jury is being instructed. We could talk about that in lots of different ways, but I not only tried juries, I presided over juries. And I knew that citizens come to our courts and they want to do the right thing. And what jury instructions should do is assist them in making good decisions. They're not lawyers. They need help. And that's what we should be doing. So I'm looking at more than just the briefs and the cold record. I'm thinking about how this decision in this specific case is going to affect other cases and into the future.
Yeah, I had a similar I like I mentioned, I spent 3 years covering the Supreme Court for the Law Bulletin. So I wrote up a lot of petitions for leave to appeal, a lot of opinions in news stories. And then I actually was tapped to serve on a jury a number of years after I left that job. And boy, what an eye-opening experience and how different it felt from that perspective. I've heard that Justice Burke, when she was chief, would occasionally sort of pull a little Henry V and go sit in the back of, bond court or something like that. I wonder if you have plans of sort of observing the judicial system quietly in action.
Not really. That is true. Absolutely true. That Justice Burke, 10 years ago, was deeply concerned about pretrial practices across our state, and specifically in our district, in the First District. And she was very concerned about that. Obviously that's an issue that is a hot button issue right now, even as the legislature is in veto session and talking about those issues. But she's been deeply involved in that for a long, long time. And so she spent a lot of time in those courtrooms. That's not exactly how I approach these concerns. I am the liaison to the Conference of Chief Judges, so I'm talking all the time with the people who are on the ground, the judges who are on the ground, trying to figure out how to actually run a court system. And I think that's really helpful for me to keep that that understanding that what are the real issues that are affecting people today, and I'm going to continue to do that.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Chief Justice Mary Jane Tice of the Illinois Supreme Court. We need to take a break in about a minute, but I guess sort of briefly, and then we can go into more detail after the break. What are your priorities? As Chief Justice, you're not only the the person who runs the actual court sessions in Springfield, but you are responsible for overseeing the administration of justice and hundreds of judges across Illinois. Briefly, what are your priorities before we need to take a break?
Well, first of all, dealing with issues of access to justice, people being able to come and have their cases heard in our court system. Secondly, I'm very interested in how mental health issues and behavioral health issues impact our courts. And then finally, the other issue I'm thinking about is how do we hear from court users? What are their needs? What do they want from our court system? We don't have a real system to do that. So those are some of my ideas.
All right. We're going to dive more into those ideas when we come back. We're speaking with Chief Justice Mary Jane Tice of the Illinois Supreme Court. This is the 21st Show. If you want to join our conversation, the number to call, as ever, 800-222-9455. More with Chief Justice Tice, and then later in the program, we'll be talking about what you can expect on your electric bills and with electric rates, as well as gas prices, energy costs in general, all coming up on the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Illinois Supreme Court Chief Justice Mary Jane Tice, who recently began her three-year term as chief on the court. And before the break, we were talking about some of her priorities for that term. Chief Justice Tice, you mentioned mental health, and this is something that I think is a very significant issue in the court systems, as you said. I mean, you have been during the time you've been a judge, there has been a major change, not just in Illinois, but across the country, in the way the government, the state deals with and tries to help or ignores people who have mental health issues. It's, I think, inarguably a good thing. We're not warehousing people in institutions the way we once might have, but the community operations that were supposed to fill in that gap have not necessarily materialized. I'm sure you've heard Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart say that he runs, in the form of the county jail, one of the largest mental health institutions in the country. Say more about how the courts interact with people who experience mental health disorders.
Let me start with something that you said before the break that I think is important for people to understand. Here in Illinois, our Constitution charges the Supreme Court not only to make decisions in cases, but to supervise the entire court system, the entire legal profession. So the court does a great deal of policy work as well as making decisions. And yes, the issue of mental health issues and how they affect our courts is a great priority. And this is nationwide. There has been the National Center for State Courts has had a task force looking at the issue of mental health issues and courts, and they just issued a report. And what's really interesting is they are looking nationwide, are looking at Illinois specifically to move forward with practical solutions with what the has been identified as a real crisis. So some of the things we've learned are things like that for so many people with mental health issues, the first contact they have or first opportunity they have for treatment is an arrest. Now, just think about that, how troubling that is. That's most people with mental illness, their gateway to treatment is the jail system. So what we find is our jails are filled with people with diagnosable illness. So yes, there is a great crisis happening in our jails. We don't have a systematic way to resolve those kinds of issues. We know there's a real crisis right now statewide where people who have been found unfit for trial or have other kind of diagnoses of competency are being held in county jails and can't even be transferred to the state mental health hospitals. So it's a very present crisis. a lot of thought has been gone into this nationwide, as you say, this is across the country. But just in the past 3 weeks, the Illinois Supreme Court has created a task force to specifically look at what we can do in our state. And I'm going to be the liaison from the Supreme Court to that task force. And for me, it is a very, very high priority.
How much of this is something the courts can do, or does this really need the legislature and executive branch to step
up? Well, there has to, of course, be some cooperation, but there are things the courts can do, because we know that the people who are coming to us are the people who need services. So we've got the population right there in front of us in our courthouses. So how do we have programming? How do we have services available? How do we educate all of the people who work in the courts how to deal with issues of mental health? There are things that we could do. And when we talk about mental health issues, it's easy to think quickly about criminal cases, because that's absolutely true. That is so often where people first come into our court system. But I'm concerned about juveniles. You know, we have kids who have been abused, and they're in our court system because they've been abused. And then guess what? They end up acting out in juvenile delinquency cases. Here's a real focal point where the courts can intervene, can be involved. I think about it in terms of other kinds of cases as well. I think about domestic relations cases. You know, people where their families are breaking up are under terrible stress emotionally. And often they make really poor decisions that have terrible impact on the rest of their lives and their families' lives. Here is a place where people are in our courtrooms, coming to the courts with real mental health issues, where we can engage with them right there in the moment. We're not there yet, but that is a very high priority moving forward.
We're coming to the end of our time together, and before I let you go, I do want to ask about, last month we talked on this program about the Judicial Declaration of Independence, which said, in essence, this is backed by a number of bar groups in Illinois, that Illinois courts can only function if they're viewed as doing their jobs in an impartial way. Obviously, you have been on the court when a number of your colleagues have been attacked in political campaigns, attempting, and in one case, successfully seeking to not retain justices. I'm sure as somebody who resides in the first judicial district up there in Cook County, you saw some of the ads for some of your colleagues. I know you probably don't want to comment on the substance or the sort of the political questions in those ads, but talk a little bit about the perception of an independent judiciary, and can that hold up in this era when there are so many moneyed interests seeking to sway the membership, you know, how the court's members are composed?
Brian, you are so correct, first of all, on your statement that the courts cannot do what we're meant to do, to administer justice, unless the people trust. They trust that the courts are acting with integrity and impartiality. Once that trust is broken down, then we have the rule of law breaks down. Our democracy breaks down. So this is not just an abstract idea that maybe we learned in seventh or eighth grade about the independence of the judiciary. This is a real core part of our democracy. So when people begin to see and think that the judiciary are just political gamesmanship, this is just partisan politics at every turn, The cornerstone of our court system begins to crack. My experience, and I come from a lot of experience, this may sound naive, but I promise you this is true. Never in my experience have I ever heard a justice or a judge speaking about a case, thinking about a case, writing about an issue based on politics. It just doesn't happen in my experience. I have great friends from all across the state, judges who I work with, all kinds of projects, who I highly admire. I have no idea what party they were elected under. It's irrelevant to the work we do, to who we are. But that's not what people have been told. And for me, as the Chief Justice, this is work that needs to be done. We need to heal. We need to promote the public's trust and confidence in our court system. That's the number one ethical issue for every judge. And in my shorthand, what I say to people all the time is, we need to work every day to earn the people's trust, now more than ever.
Chief Justice Tice, thank you for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks.
Chief Justice Mary Jane Tice is beginning her 3-year term as leading the Illinois court system. I hope we can talk again. More to come in just a moment.